Everybody with a grill thinks they know how to use it. We'll fix that misconception and teach you how to use it too on this edition of Frank Relationships.
You're listening to Frank Relationships with Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Frank Love.
Yes, those are my babies. As always, thanks for getting Daddy started today. Mwah. What's the biggest misconception when it comes to outdoor grilling with charcoal?
The biggest misconception, let's see, I guess I would say that the biggest misconception when grilling with charcoal is that it is that it's a hassle. It's actually not. I think it's probably, for me anyway, and I think for a lot of people that finally get into it, they find that, especially with grills today that have the thing underneath that allows the ash to be caught, cleanup's pretty easy, and it starts just as fast as a gas grill. So a gas grill is going to take you a solid 15 minutes to pre-warm like you would your oven, and a charcoal grill is going to take also roughly about the same amount of time to get the charcoal, 15 to 20 minutes to get the charcoal ashen. So it takes about the same amount of time, and the flavor is so much better.
Speaking of getting started, do you, this is a very, very important question. Do you, I might say so myself.
Right.
Do you use lighter fluid?
Never, ever, not. No.
Ever. Did you hear that, Nancy?
I did.
He never uses lighter fluid.
I notice people are getting away from that.
It's not even, you put it away.
Is it toxic?
You don't need it.
Oh.
Somebody who knows what they're doing doesn't need it. So we're not talking about you.
You just, most assuredly are not.
You know, you don't even have to know what you're doing to not use lighter fluid, because they have, you know, you can buy these things. They're called a chimney, and they're about $15.
Mm-hmm.
And all you do is stuff a little newspaper in the bottom of it, or some other paper, and you light the bottom of it, and there you go. That way, you don't have. First of all, you just reduce your cost because you don't have any, you know, you're not buying lighter fluid, so there's that. Secondly, you don't have that nasty smell that some people argue burns off anyway. Other people say there's a residual. I don't really know what it is, but I know I hate that smell, and I don't want to take the chance of having any residual flavor from the lighter fluid. And thirdly, you don't have the lighter fluid now somewhere around your house, you know, whether it's in your garage or wherever it is. It can be kind of a safety issue. Why have that? What if it knocks over or something in your garage? So for $15, you can take care of all that and have this chimney. It doesn't take up much space at all, and no lighter fluid.
But, Jim, I want you to understand, you said that as though she knew this. She didn't even know that.
No, all I know is, you know, I did notice on the 4th of July that my uncle was not so interested in the lighter fluid, and he was using more newspaper, and he wasn't too hot on the newspaper. So I thought, that's a change. I can remember my grandfather dousing the thing with lighter fluid.
Yeah, all of our grandfathers used to sell.
Right.
Yeah.
Now that's a fire.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. Unless those flames leaped about 6 feet in the air, we didn't really have anything going on.
Right.
And that only happened for like 30 seconds, and then they had to pour some more.
Yeah, it had to look like Jimi Hendrix's guitar. You know?
Welcome to Frank Relationships, a show where you, my brethren like me, are too young to be considered old and too old to be considered young. It's also for those of you who love and support us. We're here to provide weekly wisdom, conversation, and the information that will help create a loving and flexible parent and partner. I'm Frank Love, and you can find me, my blog, and my various social media incarnations at franklove.com. If you're listening to the show on Blog Talk Radio, please follow us, and if via iTunes, please subscribe so that you can effortlessly get each week's show. Also, if you're enjoying the show, and of course you are, please share it with your family and friends on your favorite social media platform. We're always looking for new social media friends, so please help us help our communities by spreading the word about the show. Greetings to my co-host, Nancy Goldring.
Hi, Frank.
The consummate generalist. How you doing?
I'm great.
Great. You sound great.
Thank you.
We've got a special guest today that'll help us develop an understanding of outdoor cooking. Today's guest is a nationally recognized expert on live fire cooking. He writes the Washington Post Smoke Signals Barbecue and Grilling column, where he shares scores of recipes on cooking steaks and fish to salads and desserts. He recently wrote a column that caught my eye and interest on fire management when cooking with a kettle. And when I was done with that article, my instant thought was, I've got to interview this guy.
Mm.
And I immediately told my co-host, Jim, this is, I've given him away already, but I'm going to give you throwing under the bus 101. Because I'm going to school you to something, Jim. This is how you throw someone under the bus.
Oh, my gosh.
When I saw that article, read it, was interested, I said, I've got to interview him. I talked to my co-host, Nancy, who immediately said, no thanks.
It's like, what am I going to talk to him about?
And that, my friend, is how you throw someone under the bus, right in front of the company.
Oh, my God. It wasn't that simple, Jim. Let me tell you.
He's judged the prestigious Jack Daniel's International Barbecue Competition, which attracts teams from around the world. He's made repeated tours of America's barbecue capitals and is well-versed in their regional styles. And he's also reviewed barbecue joints ranging from tiny shacks in Alabama to the Michelin 3-star Saison restaurant. I hope I said that right. Simply put, this guy knows his man stuff. Ha ha, yes.
Oh, my gosh.
So, if you, like me, want to know his preference, charcoal or gas? If barbecue is political, yeah, seriously, is it political?
Is it political?
And how to manage your fire.
Ow.
Then stay tuned as your Frank relationship team talks about barbecue and the many reasons that you probably don't know what you're doing with none other than Jim Shaheen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Before we get too deep in today's subject matter, we do a round of this and that about what's in the news, and I got something for you, Nancy.
Ooh.
Jim, please feel free to chime in if you have something to say.
All right.
I was reading an article in the Huffington Post called 10 Things Everyone Should Know About Marriage, According to Divorcees. And two of the points in the article was, if you suspect your spouse is upset about something, find out what it is at any cost. I thought that was crazy.
Yeah.
That means
it is crazy.
Pressure, nag, irritate, snoop, do whatever it takes to find out what might be bothering your partner. I can't get with that.
No. I'm divorced and I don't agree. Yeah, I don't agree with that. I mean, I think it's valuable to be interested,
yeah,
and to pursue it to some extent, and yet I think you have to understand, you have to establish a kind of balance and know when to back off.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the only thing that I can think of is that some people like or need to be loved in that way. They need you to pursue. Yeah, I mean, they need you to just like beg them for, mm-hmm, what's wrong, you know.
Jeff, you look like I've said something that touched home.
You know what? After you get to a certain age, you're not as needy.
Mm-hmm. We hope.
And I don't think relationships are either. Mm-hmm. They're hard work.
Mm-hmm.
But there's too many extraneous things that are just that, extraneous. Stick to the core. Stick to what's important. Stick to the love and devotion,
yeah,
and those things you have in common. And if you don't have things in common, either try to find them, which could be hard work, or call it a day. Go to a barbecue.
Jim, you got anything on that?
I think you guys pretty much covered it. I mean, I agree. I think, you know, I've been lucky enough to be married to my wife for 30 years, and I'm from the East Coast. She's from Texas. Actually, she in some ways was the one who kind of in some way, you could say, introduced me to barbecue.
Wow.
I don't know. When I see that there's something bugging her, I try to judge at what level are we at?
Right.
This is a level that she needs me to say, hey, how are you doing? What's going on? Are you feeling bad about something? Or are we at the level to just let it alone and let her work it out and not pick at it? So, yeah, that's, you know, chemistry is a funny thing.
Indeed. There's Portland. Yeah, you ever been to Portland, Nancy?
I have actually been.
That's a no.
On a layover in Portland,
yeah,
but I haven't
that doesn't count.
Seen the place.
No, you haven't been to Portland.
Okay, I haven't been to Portland. So, thank you.
Jeff?
No, I just know that that's where Nike is.
Huge.
It's a city, well, number one, it has a lot of swingers clubs, has the most strip bars per capita.
What?
It has an annual porn festival, and is considered the city that's making polyamory easy.
Interesting.
So apparently, like, you can't go anywhere without seeing a polyamorous couple in Portland.
And
that's
you still live
heavy.
In D.C.?
Yeah, how about that? And you know what I think is so fascinating? You always hear about what a great town Portland is. No one ever mentions these things.
Hey. Yeah.
This is, let me watch
maybe,
my language.
Maybe people don't think that's great.
Well, I am completely blown away that there's such a charge there around sex and sexuality, and there's no conversation about it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Hi.
Imagine that. Well, I tell you one thing. The next time you ask me if I've ever been to Portland, the answer will not be no.
Oh, my.
Oh, I'm going to check this out.
Oh.
I gotta see.
Buy some sneakers and then share them.
Exactly.
Okay, Jim. Let's get to the good stuff. What is fire management?
Let's see. Fire management would be the thing about when you're grilling with fire, real fire, which is to say wood or charcoal fire. It's variable, as anybody who's done this kind of stuff knows. I mean, whether you're putting on a burger or you're doing a pork butt or whatever, you're going to have fire that's going to have different hot spots in it. It's not going to be even like a gas oven or a gas stove, say. It's going to be uneven, and it's going to also have, from the beginning, when you get it going, it's going to have different temperatures throughout its cook. So, for example, if you want to do a steak real fast, then you're going to put that on in the early part of the fire when it's really super hot. And then later on, you might put, say, I don't know, peaches or mangoes or something when the fire isn't quite so hot. So knowing your fire, how to manage it, when to add wood or charcoal to keep it going and at what temperature is, it's pretty important. And it just sort of comes with practice and time.
All right.
Okay.
Jim, you've been married 30 years. I know you're going to know what to do with this question. It's
stand
really.
Stand down.
It's another important one.
Oh, gosh.
Why is it that women are supposed to inherently be in the kitchen seasoning the meat? I mean, it's not even a question of whether that's supposed to be what's going on.
What?
It's definitely what should happen. Why is that, Jim? Do you have any idea?
Well, I can tell you one thing.
It's a risky area. Actually, I don't have much of an answer for that. Because
I have the answer.
Because, and I'll tell you why. It's because my wife doesn't cook. I do all the cooking. It's
touchdown.
Not the barbecuing, but I love cooking. I enjoy cooking of all sorts. And so So I'm the one, like later today, as a matter of fact, I'll be seasoning the ribs that I'm going to be putting on, and, you know, I'll be making a couple of seasoning rubs. And so I do all that. What I do find in barbecue circles is actually, my wife and I were talking about this just this morning, as a matter of fact, about how, you know, they talk about the barbecue spouse, and in these circles, they say that the guy gets all this credit for having taken a chunk of meat, putting it on fire, pulling it off, and everybody oohs and ahs, whereas traditionally, typically, women tend to do the sides, yep. They put together the table, mm-hmm. They do everything else, and yet it's the guy who gets this credit for doing this one thing, and you know, this is a you know, a conversation that's happening. I will tell you this. This is really interesting, actually, that Weber, you know, the big grill company, mm-hmm. that has, you see those kettles all over the place in people's backyards,
right.
Did a study, and the number of women who are grilling now, the percentage of women grilling now, is way up from what it was a few years ago. Mm-hmm. So roughly something like 25%. Of women in a household with a grill, mm-hmm. Grill much of the time, whereas that number was down around, I believe it was, I don't have this in front of me, I would have checked on it had I known it was going to come up, but it was, I think it was 17% just a few years ago. So women are clearly getting more comfortable with, you know, with grilling and smoking, and in fact, there are some websites out there dedicated to women grilling, wow. and smoking, and even classes on
that.
Women specifically grilling and smoking. And there's a variety of them out there that you can find online. And yeah, so it's sort of expanding out of the traditional sense of what women have typically done in the kitchen or to help, you know, help out at a barbecue, to where they're beginning to take the tongs themselves.
Funny enough, to compliment what you were saying, is it's not unknown or missed for women to be those in the background,
right?
Making whatever work,
yeah.
works. I mean, it kind of is how things are in many sectors.
In the
That's
support
right.
role.
Yeah. So even though my wife and my sister-in-law, they and my cousin, they, when I'm grilling, they season the meat. I just give it to them. I walk in, I drop down the brontosaurus leg in the kitchen, and they season it
so that it doesn't taste like a brontosaurus.
What's the difference, Jim, between grilling and barbecuing?
Grilling is fast. Barbecuing is slow. Grilling is hot. Barbecue is soft. So, for example, you would grill a hot dog, you would grill a steak, you would grill fish. And those things that take anywhere from, say, 3 to 10 minutes or so, 12 minutes, is grilling. If you're going to get a low, what they call low, meaning low temperature, and slow, meaning over a long period of time, using wood, then that's barbecue. So that pork butts, ribs, beef brisket, that sort of stuff that you're going to put on and it's just going to go at roughly in the neighborhood of about 225 degrees or so over X amount of hours, anywhere, say, from 5 hours for ribs, say, to, you know, 12 or 18 or even longer for a beef brisket. And so, yeah, that's the basic difference.
And so it has nothing to do with the sauce, barbecue sauce?
Oh, no, gosh. That's yet another debate. Everything in barbecue is a debate. There are those, like, primarily, the barbecue sauce thing is, no, the barbecue sauce has nothing to do with grilling, or because you can put a sauce on anything. You can put a sauce, let's say, if you could put, you know, some kind of a Worcestershire A1 sauce or something on your steak. You could put any number of kinds of sauces if you wanted to on your burger, and you could do the same, of course, on your rib. So it's not about the sauce, but there is a separate debate about the definition of barbecue and that it does involve the sauce, and the people, like a lot of Texans, for example, believe that barbecue is not about the sauce. It's about the smoky. It's about the method, and it's about how you smoke the meat, you bring it out, and then you sauce it if you prefer as an option on the table. Mm-hmm. But the meat doesn't come sauced, generally speaking, in Central Texas barbecue. And now then, other places, of course, it's very much a part of the barbecue, like in Kansas City, for example, where you get all these great sauces that come out of Kansas City. It's very much a part of the identity of that barbecue in places like Kansas City and Memphis.
What are some of the... I am so inspired to say, what about New York City? And then have somebody say, New York City? Okay, all right, just...
New York City?
Thank you, thank you.
That's what I'm here for. Should have sent me the script.
Now get back in the kitchen and season that meat.
Thank you, Jeff.
Okay, I'm going to let it go. That's because I don't eat animals, and I can take a more relaxed approach this attack.
Okay. Is that right? You don't eat meat?
I don't eat meat anymore, no.
Oh, my gosh. I got to tell you, there are some great books out there and stuff on grilling and barbecuing vegetables, and
nice.
It's one of my favorite things to do. I love doing that.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that.
There are so many things you can do with vegetables. You know, I've done last night I was traveling. I just got back from upstate New York, and I got back late, and I had a commitment with people, but my what I was wanting to do, but I got back too late because this is one of my favorite easy go-to meals, is to make an eggplant parmesan on the grill.
Nice.
And so you can make your favorite sauce or buy a sauce, and then you just slice up the eggplant, and, you know, you put your cheese on there just like you would anything else, and then you put it on the what we call the indirect side of the grill, so you have the coals on one side and nothing on the other, and then you just put the top on for, I think it's about 40 minutes or so, and you have this lovely sort of a little bit of a woodsy kind of flavor of this eggplant parmesan. And all that is all vegetables.
Nice.
You got a main course.
See that?
He is interesting to
yes.
you.
Yes, yes. I was thinking, well, what am I going to talk to this guy about? He barbecues and grills meat.
All right. Now.
Yeah, no,
I'm happy.
So much.
Thank you.
Well, another one of my favorites is I think it was in the Washington Post article that you're talking about, is to simply like the Italian antipasti, where you have grilled vegetables, the zucchini and the onion, and maybe some tomatoes and some eggplant, and it just makes for such an easy. None of that takes more than 10 minutes.
Right.
Those are 10 minutes. Next thing you know, and you can do it in the morning, and just put some Saran wrap over it. And then serve it in the evening, so it's done and out of the way. You don't have to worry about it, and you pull it out, and everybody oohs and ahs because it looks so great.
Right.
It seems so time intensive, but it is like a great sort of like party thing. There's another thing you could do, which was in a different article that I just wrote on reviewing various books that came out, and this is a super easy one. And I'll give credit to one of the kings of grilling and barbecue, Stephen Raiklin, from his book in which he does camembert cheese on a soaked wood plank, a cedar plank. And you just put that on the grill and do that for maybe, I don't know, 10 minutes or something with some kind of a jelly that you might like, say an apricot or something, and then if you like it spicy, slice up a few jalapeno, put it on there, and it starts to get a little melty,
okay.
And then everything all comes together, and that is a spectacular appetizer that took nothing.
Oh, and you said the book is by Stephen Rankin?
Yeah, it's his new book. It's called Project Smoke.
Project Smoke, okay.
Look at
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he's got some terrific vegetable things in there, recipes in there. I'll tell you, there's, believe it or not, if you look in any number of barbecue books, they all have stuff about, they're not just all about meat. There's all sorts of different stuff in almost any barbecue book you were to pick up.
Great. Thank you so much for that, Jim.
See,
sure.
You follow me and I take care of you.
No. He would have left me out there in animal land.
You might be interested in.
Okay.
And it's called The Gardener and the Grill.
Nice.
The Gardener and the Grill. And if you want to write this down, The Gardener and the Grill has, it's by a woman named Karen Adler, A-D-L-E-R, and Judith Fertig, F-E-R-T-I-G. And it is such a terrific overview of, I mean, it's a good, thick, sturdy, wonderful book about so much that you can do with vegetables. It's a terrific book.
Fabulous.
I like to grill asparagus, squash.
Oh, yeah.
Mushrooms. I really like grilling mushrooms. Okay. Those are, I got a thing about mushrooms anyway. They're like a great meat substitute.
Yeah.
Yes.
And even eggplant. I like grilling eggplant.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, man. You're talking my language now. You make a nice sandwich out of that, too. Like, you take those mushrooms and that eggplant, maybe a little onion. You grill all that up, and you put whatever you like on it in terms of, like, there's a great kind of jalapeno sauce that they have over at Eastern Market in D.C. And, you know, you put maybe a little spicy mayonnaise or something. Oh, it's spectacular. It makes a great lunch.
Nice.
Hey, Jim, I actually saw this at Williams-Sonoma. They were doing a demonstration. They have these indoor air grills. What's your impression or opinion on those?
It depends on which one you're talking about, because there are a couple of different types. But I think, you know, especially in northern climes, of course, where you can't always be, well, some of us do, but many of us don't go out in the cold and the snow through the wintertime. I'm not that crazy about them as a barbecue substitute during the time that you can go out. Why not do it, you know, the real way? But I do like them if you just want that flavor. And, you know, it's 28 degrees outside and it's been snowing all day. And you go, man, I'm going to try to pretend like I'm, you know, it's the middle of summer. And they work great. I got to tell you, there's all sorts of ways that you can grill indoors and smoke indoors that are really pretty easy. They have something called the Cameron. It's a company called Cameron, and they make a indoor smoking thing that you can just pop in the oven. And they have this little sort of, put a little wood chips in the bottom of it. It's kind of like a baking, like a big baking tray. And it's not at all complicated. You don't have to know anything about technology. It's so easy, and you can get a lovely smoke on whatever, fish or vegetables or whatever you want. And I think they run, I just don't remember how much they are now, but in my mind, I think they're like about $50 or something. But whatever they are, if you live, a lot of people have a problem where they live in an apartment, they're not allowed to smoke or grill. I find that the Cameron's a pretty good, you know, not a bad way to get that same kind of flavor.
Something you brought up, Jim, was the weather. And for, in my humble opinion and my personal experience, the weather and grilling on the barbecue, have,
yes,
on the grill,
yes,
they have nothing to do with each other. I can't think of a day when it's ever been too cold
or too hot
to throw something on the grill.
Well, you know what? That actually is an evolution also, I feel. I can remember when it seemed like you only grill in the summer or when the weather's nice.
Some novices still would think that.
Clearly things have changed.
You have anything on that, Jim?
Well, you know, I agree with you. As a matter of fact, we're coming up on my favorite time of the year. I love barbecuing in the fall. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the crisp days are spectacular for barbecuing. You're out there, especially if you're doing big things with the, you know, you're standing by the grill a lot. And it does, you know, like this weekend is probably, to tell you the truth, is like my least favorite time to grill, because it's going to be like 95 degrees, it's going to be 100 degrees, and, you know, you're just making hot hotter.
Right,
but
right.
I will be grilling, and nonetheless, I'm doing a barbecue boot camp at the Hill Center in D.C. on Sunday. And so a number of students have signed up. I think there might even be, I don't know if it's sold out yet or not. I know earlier in the week they had like two left or something. But in any event, so this Sunday, which they forecast to be the hottest day of the summer, I'll be out there behind the grill for 3 hours.
Aren't you lucky?
Doing stuff. Having said that, you know, typically on a day like that, if I wasn't doing the boot camp, on a day like that, if I was going to grill at all, I would tend to do one of two things. I would not do medium smoking or grilling, I would do either quick where I'm out there for 15 or something minutes, like a steak or whatever, or I would do long, low and slow, where I put it in and leave it alone. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, if you're looking, you're not cooking. So you don't even pick up the lid. You just let it go for whatever, 8 hours or whatever it is that you're doing. And so that way you're not standing by that grill in that super hot heat. But you're still able to do it. So, I mean, personally, I think there are certain days that are better than others. And I grill year-round, but my favorite season is fall. I just love it.
Nice. Barbecue Boot Camp. Tell us about it.
Well, Barbecue Boot Camp is something that, as I say, the Hill Center in Washington, D.C., in Capitol Hill, does. This Sunday I'll be doing a demonstration of fire management. Mm-hmm. And it's all charcoal. It's an all charcoal and wood demonstration. And we're going to do ribs. We're going to do wings. Then I'll do some salads to go with them. And we'll talk about some of the very same things we're talking about here today. And then everybody will eat.
Is it $500 to register? 50?
I think it's $85.
Okay. Interesting. There's a conversation that exists around carcinogens and mm-hmm. barbecuing, mm-hmm. grilling. What do you say to that?
That to me, you know, it's all about the science. I don't say anything about it that isn't said by science. So what if you look at, you know, the CDC and others who have studied this, what we have found is that it's really the link between the carcinogens and grilling or smoking. First of all, in my readings have been, well, how shall I put this? It's not super solid. They themselves will say that, you know, when you read these, there'll be a little caveat, like we're not sure that there is a link, but it appears to be that there may be a link. And that link is going to be more in the fast, hot grilling, like when you char your steak. Mm-hmm. That's going to create what they are concerned may be carcinogens, more than when you're doing a long smoke. It's that reaction of the hot fire with the meat and the fat that's creating the chemical reaction that they are concerned may be carcinogenic. But again, you know, if you go and look up the studies, you'll see they're just not sure that there is a link. Mm-hmm. And I'm not suggesting, I'm perfectly willing. I have no interest in trying to, you know, defend grilling or smoking just because it's something I do. If the science, you know, confirms that there is a, if there is definitely a link there, then of course I think we should all be really careful about that. What the science also shows, though, is this, and that is, so far from what they can tell, the amount that you'd have to eat for it to have an impact on your health is so massive. It's not going to happen on an occasional steak now and again. You're not going to eat a steak and get cancer. Mm-hmm. So I feel still pretty comfortable about grilling, especially, as I say, it's far more about the grilling, that it's not
a big deal.
That is not necessarily an unhealthy activity.
Gotcha. Gas or charcoal?
I think by far charcoal.
By far charcoal. I'm right there with you. You have something to say?
I don't, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. What? Yeah. What is it?
Well, the only thing I wanted to add to the comment that Jim was making about grilling and the your question around carcinogens is that what I did see in doing a little bit of looking around was that it wasn't the food itself, it was the smoke.
Mm, okay.
The issue was the smoke.
Well, it's really more about the interaction of that fire on the meat and the fat of the meat and the way the chemical reaction occurs that's causing it. Now, okay. What you're talking about with the smoke is there's actually different. Smoke is an extremely complicated chemical compound, and there's actually methane in it and chemicals that, on some level, we would try to avoid. But as it interacts with itself, that is to say, the other chemicals in smoke itself, and with the meat, it tends not to really create a carcinogenic situation. So, it's that one is not. As I say, it's really more generally about the fast grilling than it is about the long, smoking. And it may be, you know, because of what the chemical compounds that they're I don't know, you know, what is it you read, but it's possible that the chemical compounds that make up the smoke was something that caused some concern. But generally, what I've read from the CDC and the Centers for Disease Control. Don't support that.
Okay.
Okay.
There's barbecue that I've had that I actually didn't like. There was like vinegary or something. There's different like taste to different regions. Would you weigh in on would you try to describe North Carolina barbecue and Texas and
Florida?
Yeah, whatever there is. Would you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, sure. There are four acknowledged barbecue capitals that have distinct styles, and they are North Carolina, Texas, Memphis, and Kansas City. And North Carolina is divided into two sides. There's the Eastern Jeez. North Carolina style, and there's the Western North Carolina style. And North Carolina, as so many places on the East Coast, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, will claim to be the one true barbecue, that it, you know, barbecue sort of was a
born
multicultural
there.
Creation when the Europeans came to the Americas, and they observed the Taino Indians of the Caribbean slow smoking foods in an indirect manner, and so the word that they understood the Indians to be using was something that was kind of, we understand, to be unpronounceable mm-hmm. to them, and it became something like barbacoa or something like that. Mm-hmm. The Spanish then called it barbacoa, and then it became anglicized into barbecue. And so that style of putting coals, you know, hardwood coals, which is to say that the wood is burned down to coals and put underneath the food about whatever distance it might be, but so it's not really, and so it's cooking very, very slowly, so the fat renders into it, is what we consider to be barbecue on some level. And so North Carolina does that in some way in their pits. And they then, when pigs were introduced to the Americas, that's kind of what really, really, really took off. And so
in pork.
Eastern North Carolina, they do whole hog mm-hmm. over glowing oak and or hickory embers. And then they finish it with a sauce that can be roughly traced all the way back to, well, hundreds of years, and it is a vinegar pepper-based sauce. You know, the English back then had a similar sauce, and that they would use. And so that's sort of your vinegar sort of flavor that you're talking about. Then if you go to Western North Carolina, they do roughly the same thing in terms of the cooking method, but they use pork shoulder, not a whole hog, mm-hmm. and they will add a little tomato or ketchup to that otherwise thin vinegar pepper sauce. And that basically defines North Carolina barbecue. If you go to Texas, if you go to Central Texas, because there are so many parts of Texas, but it's really Central Texas that gets discussed all the time as the Texas barbecue. And that, on some measure, was a result of German immigration using their smoking history to create these meat markets that became barbecue houses later on, and they tend to go far more with beef. Mm-hmm. So they have beef sausage will be big, and, of course, beef brisket is big there. And they use a different style, but it is also low and slow, and they have an offset. So they put the fire not directly beneath the meat, but in what's called a fire box, which is an attached box that then wafts smoke across the meat inside the cooking chamber.
Over a long period
and so
of time.
Those are, you know, so if you get, you know, sort of brisket, comes unsauced, generally speaking, mm-hmm. not always, but generally, mm-hmm. And that beef sausage and usually ribs, those will be the three primary meats that you're going to get, and that's going to be Texas barbecue. You know, in Kansas City, you have all sorts of things that are getting barbecued and grilled and smoked and whatnot. It's very eclectic, and they have all sorts of sauces, and you know, they're sort of a city of sauce. They just have lots of different, you know, the Gates sauce and just so many others. And so Kansas City has a combination. They have brisket, they'll have pork, all that. Now, all this being said, we're seeing a big blending these days. Down in Texas over the last several years, you've seen a lot more pulled pork down there, mm-hmm. and all over the East Coast now and all over North Carolina, you're seeing brisket. So you're seeing more and more of a blending. And then finally, in Memphis, it also tends to be a sauced barbecue. They have what they call dry and wet ribs. So the dry is just, you know, seasonings but no sauce. The wet comes sauced. And they also have these great pork sandwiches, typically with usually sauced, oftentimes, as with North Carolina, with coleslaw on top. Mm-hmm. So, and in Memphis, man, they do so much cool stuff. One of them is a barbecue spaghetti.
Whoa.
And
Oh, it's, I got to tell you, at first it kind of sounds, oh, why would anybody do that? But, man, once you sit down and you have it, it's great. Okay. And I've recreated it. I think I have a recipe for it online. I'm not sure. But anyway, it's so those are the basic four. Now, there are a lot of other variants of those. But basically that's, you know, though, when you're talking about regional differences, that's basically it. Mm-hmm.
What are the super duper tools that you use? I know you've got a major garage full of special barbecue tools. What do you use?
Tongs. I use tongs. I when I do my barbecue camp tomorrow, I'm going to hold up the tongs and say, "This is all you need."
Wow.
Because, now, yeah, do you need a spatula? Yeah. I believe that you keep this, we're talking about caveman stuff here.
Yes, sir.
So keep it simple.
Yes.
You just don't have to overcomplicate this stuff. People buy all this stuff, you know, that they think is going to improve their game. If you know about how long to leave something on over a fire, you got it. That's all there is to it. There's not much more. So I won't poke my meat with with a fork, because I don't want to release any of the juices. So I just use long-handled tongs for almost everything. One thing I do like to have is a vegetable holder, so that if I have, I don't know, like say grape tomatoes or something like that, I can put them in there, and they're not going to fall through the grate that way.
Mm.
So, you know, those are pretty much the primary things. And as I say, you know, you're going to want to have, of course, a spatula if you're going to do whatever it might be, say, a fish, for mm-hmm. example. It would be going to be easier to turn than if you're using tongs, whereas with a steak, I always use tongs. But, you know, burgers, you're going to use a spatula. But, yeah, there's just not that many. You don't have to spend a lot of money in this, you know. You can. God knows they have all this stuff out there for you to buy. But you just don't need to buy much.
Jim, I have actually two questions, the first of which is a local D.C. type of question. Red Hot and Blue, Famous Dave's, Hogs on the Hill. I don't know if you can endorse or not any of these places. Are they all similar, or is there one better than another for specific barbecue type items?
Well, you know, Red Hot and Blue was partly founded by a Republican strategist who became the who was a strategist for the first George Bush. Mm.
So you're saying he copied the recipe from a Democrat who started Famous Dave's?
Well, Lee Atwater, I don't know if you know that name.
Oh, I know that name.
He's a famous name in political strategy circles. He was the guy who engineered the win by Bush over Dukakis when they were down by 10 points coming out of the conventions. And he, Lee Atwater, was born and raised in what he called the middle of the middle class, which was in Columbia, South Carolina. And he loved barbecue. Mm-hmm. And he became the, after you know, his turn at getting the president elected, he became the head of the RNC, the Republican National Committee. And he also co-founded Red Hot and Blue, which was intended as a an homage, if you will, to Memphis barbecue, and then, you know, it took off, became a chain, and there you have it.
Is there food any good?
So that's kind of the background on Red Hot and Blue, and it became something, I guess, in a way, a little bit of a template of a lot of kind of places to follow, which is to say, they had all sorts of different kinds of. They were kind of region busting in a way, even though, I mean, they had the dry and wet ribs that I was talking about. That's kind of very Memphis-y. Mm-hmm. But it was also, there was something broad-based about it. And as barbecue has expanded, what we've seen is it used to be, you'd go to a barbecue place. Generally speaking, back in the day, you know, 30 or something years ago, most barbecue places were relatively small. They weren't these big restaurants that you see now. And the guy, the proprietor, would take some pride in exactly what it was that he was serving, and he would have his own signature sauce. Mm-hmm. Now you go in somewhere, and they have these sauces that are supposed to be representative of all these areas of the country. So you get 4, 6, 8 different sauces in there. So there's no real signature. And they serve all this different stuff, so that it's kind of a pan-regionalism of barbecue, which is, you know, kind of homogenizing what otherwise had been, or maybe on some level still is, a hyper-regional cuisine. Mm-hmm. So when you go to a lot of the places, whether in D.C. or somewhere else, you know, those are some of the things that you're seeing. Now, one of the things that'll be, well, that was different, Hill Country Barbecue in Washington, D.C., in Penn Quarter, is based on a Texas place, a famous Texas place in south of Austin, a town called Lockhart. And Kreutz Barbecue is this world-famous barbecue place on which Hill Country was patterned because the owner would spend his summers, he's for the owners from Bethesda, and he would spend his summers down in Lockhart with his grandfather who lived down there. And so he loved it so much and remembered it as he became older that he wanted to recreate that experience. So he created a very hyper-regional idea of Texas barbecue and did it in New York and Washington, D.C. Since having done that, which, you know, was, he used a kind of a classic on-the-side Texas sauce. It was counter ordering, so it wasn't table ordering. It was the main thing was brisket. They also had a beef rib, all that. But since then, they've added pulled pork, which kind of then, you know, as I say, blurs the lines a little bit. But that's kind of the way things are going these days. So, but, you know, for a more singular experience, you know, you would get, you know, you would get something like that. You might go there. There was a place that was terrific called D-City Smokehouse, but that is no longer as of, I don't know, maybe a year or something ago. And the pitman there, who a lot of people regard as, you know, one of the best around, is, I think he's trying to see if he might be able to get another place going at some point. But he had lots of different stuff, but it was a different approach to barbecue because it wasn't quite so traditional. He'd have, you know, different kinds of things that he'd do on his sandwiches and whatnot. And, but yeah, his food was excellent.
Frank, I'm sorry, Jim, my second question is actually kind of a phenomenon amongst barbecue fanatics. I was once in Morganton, North Carolina, about 2 hours outside of Raleigh, and the locals kept raving about this barbecue. You got to go to this barbecue place. I forgot the name of it. And so I went with a group of people, and it was good. In fact, it was very good. I really can't tell if it was any better than a place like a Red Hot and Blue, but the volume of food was. You ordered a plate, and it was, I mean, just food for days. Mm. And that has, and there's something about that. That's what they were proud of. Look, you're not just getting this. Mm. You're getting three slabs of ribs and the brisket and the chicken.
More than you can eat.
And that's part, there is a phenomenon. Even when you watch these barbecue battles, look at how much food there is.
Yeah. Okay.
And do you find that? I mean, that's an attraction. Guys love food. Mm-hmm. Guys love a lot of food. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing.
Well, I can fall into that trap, too. There's just something about, I mean, first of all, it's kind of, a throwback to the idea of what barbecue is. I mean, barbecue is something shared. Nobody throws a barbecue for themselves. You know, it just doesn't happen. When you do a barbecue, a true barbecue, and by that I don't mean, you know, grilling burgers, hot dogs, or steaks. I'm talking about the long smoke with the brisket or the pulled pork or something like that. Well, you're talking about an 8-pound piece of meat or bigger. And you're going to share that with family. You're going to share that with friends. Oftentimes, it's going to be a special occasion. I mean, that's a lot of what barbecue in some ways grew up as in America, as a mm-hmm. special occasion kind of food. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you'd have the, you know, in the fall, you'd have the harvest, and then there'd be these big barbecues, or there'd be political barbecues in which, you know, candidates would throw a barbecue and, you know, hundreds of people would come, even thousands, and it was a way to sort of feed everybody. So barbecue goes back to a sense of community. So today, when we're so atomized and we have, you know, it's a very different world, if you make a barbecue now, you're not going to have hundreds of people at it. Mm-hmm. You're going to maybe have whatever, 10, 20 maybe, if you have a big family reunion, maybe as many as 50 or something. But you're still going to have that sense of making sure that everybody that is coming to your home is going to have plenty to eat, and it's kind of this kind of, I don't know, proletarian opulence, if you will. So you got lots of potato salad. You've got lots of coleslaw. You've got lots of beans and stuff. So I think there's that aspect to it, that it's a food meant to be shared. And when you're sharing something, you want to make sure that nobody ever, you know, that you don't run out. On the other hand, and there is another hand, and that is this, one final thing before I get into that, and that is it's a rural food, too. Typically, you didn't see barbecue that much in the cities. It was really something that you saw out in the rural areas. And now, due to technology, you can see these places all over everywhere now, D.C., New York, you know, wherever. And so so rural, you know, eating has always been hearty eating. I mean, they did a lot of hard work. They weren't sitting behind a computer, you know, all day long. So, you know, that sort of bounty of food that was coming, you know, from the farms was something that was intrinsic in country eating. So all that goes into sort of, I think, the positive aspects of a barbecue and a community sense of a barbecue. The downside, what I was going to say, or on the other hand, is that you get with, if you go, I personally am not that, I try to be conscious of not overdoing it too much. I can be very guilty of it if you ask any of my friends. But believe it or not, it is something that I'm aware of, and you try at the same time to you try to walk that line of making sure everybody has plenty and you're really proud of what you put out and you're very happy with if they're happy.
Right.
But at the same time, you just don't really want to overdo it. It can get kind of obscene.
Right. Wasteful.
Yes, wasteful.
You spoke of politics and barbecue. Can you, I know you have an opinion on the meshing of the two. Would you share that?
Well, it has played a huge role in America and in some levels the development of America, you know, ever since the very beginning. I mean, when I was talking about celebration barbecue and special event barbecue, you know, when you had the Taino Indian of the Caribbean, which I talked about, then African Americans brought here as slaves, helped define this thing we call barbecue because there on the plantations, you know, was the slaves who were cooking this meat for the master's table. And typically, these things would happen, as I say, generally speaking, not always, but usually a special event like a 4th of July or a fall harvest social gathering or something. So now you're meshing these different kinds of approaches to this cuisine. So you have American Indian, you have African American, you have some white European, and now you're getting this very sort of, you know, multicultural development of this cuisine. But the people who are actually cooking it are the ones who are kind of defining it for that area. So since it was primarily, and I kind of want to try to be careful on how I actually phrase this because all this stuff can get very fraught. Mm. But you know, I wrote a piece on not long ago on African Americans and barbecue, and how was their legacy disappearing underneath this onslaught of all these multi-million-dollar places that have been opening up all over the country, and to what extent is that heritage still alive? And I got a fair amount of hate mail saying that,
really?
You know, I was ignoring the contributions of others, that it wasn't just about African Americans and da-da-da, which isn't at all what I said. So I'm going to try again. And what I am saying is that I believe that barbecue is the one true indigenous American food. Mm-hmm. You can trace it all the way back to the very earliest days before even the founding of the country. And it has these different contributions to it. That said, the people that cook it are the people who define it. Mm-hmm. And that has, in no small measure, been slave cooking, plantation cooking, African Americans. And when you're putting seasonings and stuff on, say, a whole animal, and remember, way back then, you were doing whole animal. It wasn't like they had slaughterhouses and trains and they were moving shoulders and briskets around. It would be a whole oxen or a whole pig or something. So when you are seasoning it, you are helping to create the difference. It's you who are doing that. So that's where you get this sort of micro-regionalism of the barbecue, which almost like accents, you know, you talk to somebody and you can kind of tell a little bit where they're from. Mm-hmm. So it is with barbecue. And so I would say that when you talk about politics and barbecue, you're getting into race, you're getting into, you know, well, all sorts of things having to do with, mm-hmm. with this thing we call barbecue. And so one of them is that, you know, who owns this thing called barbecue? And, you know, it's certainly got co-ownership. I don't think anybody could argue with that. But I also think that especially today when you a lot of places open and they have these PR guys and they build these, you know, it's certainly somewhat further away from its roots than it was even, say, 30 years ago.
But our elections...
So that's part of it. You know? There are other aspects, too. I mean, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was upheld at the Supreme Court because there was a challenge to it by a barbecue place in Birmingham called Ollie's, saying that he didn't have to serve blacks. And so he said he didn't have to serve blacks because it was the Civil Rights of Civil Rights Act of 1964 was, did not, he said, because he didn't get anything from out of state, all his purchases were done in state, then he was not beholden to the law. Well, you know, they found that, you know, some of his meat was being shipped from out of state, and he was near an interstate, so that there was interstate commerce, people visiting this place who weren't just local. And so it was the Interstate Commerce Clause that upheld the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and that was brought by, you know, a barbecue place in Birmingham, Alabama.
Okay.
And so there's all sorts of stuff with politics that you can do. LBJ had what they called the barbecue diplomacy, where he had the German head of state join him at his Texas ranch, and he would conduct a lot of his politics there. So, you know, there's a lot.
Real quick, before we wrap up, I got a few questions that I want to get in that are just like to the point, like maybe 10-second answers.
All right.
Best fish for grilling?
Swordfish and salmon.
Okay. Direct fire, what is it?
Fire that is immediately beneath your food.
All of it, meaning the whole kettle?
Yes, it does. Yes.
Okay.
If you're cooking direct, that's, yeah, right.
Indirect fire.
Indirect fire, you put the fire on one side of the kettle, leave the other side without the fire so that you can cook, you know, on both sides of the grill and keep the stuff warm and warm it through on the other side.
Three zone fire.
Three zone fire is where you create kind of like an indirect, but you create a second mound in between so that you can do sort of a fast, a little slower, and then a warming area more or less.
Steps.
I'm sorry, what's that?
Steps. Is there a technique in terms of how you do your coals called steps? Okay.
I think what you might be referring to is like the steps that you use for it might be the snake or the sea or the ring of smolder, which is to say that there's a you make this ring around the perimeter of your Weber grill with about a 6-inch to a 1-foot gap so that the ring doesn't match meat rather, and it'll go forever. Then you just start one end of it. And it'll go for easily 6 hours. So you could do a pork butt on your Weber grill. You don't have to buy a expensive smoker.
So you put that ring around the entire perimeter of the kettle. And then rotisserie.
Rotisserie is, you know, you need an outlet. And then you have this electric gadget that will, just like, you know, you go in town somewhere and you get, you know, these great sort of Peruvian chickens. And you just put it on the rotisserie, goes around and around over the coals, and that's what a rotisserie is.
Rocklands. There's, and I'm saying that in terms of the name of the place here in D.C. Any opinion on Rocklands?
Well, I'll tell you what. I think one of the things that's terrific about Rocklands is that, you know, he actually cooks, unlike so many nowadays, over all wood. Mm-hmm. A lot of people these days cook with a gas oven with some wood enhancement. Mm-hmm. He cooks all wood like the old days.
Gotcha. And where, give me two good restaurants in the D.C. area, or give me two in the D.C. area and two for me and Jeff to road trip to.
Let's see. There's, well, that's a big question to ask me at the end here. I think for road tripping, you could go to maybe Texas Jack's. Isn't really a road trip necessarily. It's in Northern Virginia. It's a relatively new place. It's pretty good.
Okay.
And, I mentioned Hill Country before. It's also pretty good.
Those are both in the D.C. area.
There is Ashman Brothers, which is a little bit of a road trip. I can't remember exactly. I may be wrong about that name. Might be Carolina Brothers in Ashman. I wish I could recall the name of that. But there's a couple. And so.
Any great sauces or rubs?
Well, I make my own, so I'm not really. I mean, there are sauces and rubs out there that I like, but they tend to be these very boutique-y type things that, I usually go to the place like Rodney Scott down in Hemingway, South Carolina makes a fantastic sauce, but you have to go there to get it. Commercially speaking, Pork Barrel Barbecue makes a nice sauce. They're local, and they actually make a line of sauces, and they do a pretty good job of making some cool sauces. That's good. And I think you have, personally, I've always kind of liked Gates sauce out of Kansas City. It's just a very traditional thickish red type sauce, but I've always liked it. And then we talked earlier about the vinegar base, but if you like a sort of that, I know you weren't crazy about it, but if you like that kind of thing, mm-hmm. there's something called Scotch sauce. That's a pretty good representation of that Eastern North Carolina style.
You're listening to Frank Relationships, and we've been talking with Washington Post columnist and live fire cooking aficionado, Jim Shaheen. Jim has been educating us on the ways of the grill. Jim, how can our listeners find you and what you're up to?
Best way to do it, just simply Google my name and Washington Post, or you could go to the Washington Post and then do a search for Jim Shaheen. Those would be the two easiest ways.
Along today's journey, we've discussed politics and barbecue, vegetables, grilling for Nancy.
Thank you.
And the different regions and their characteristics related to barbecue. Thank you to my co-host, Nancy. Thanks to Jeff Newman, my engineer. And thank you to my guest, Jim Shaheen.
Thank you.
You've been great. I hope you had as much fun as I've had hanging out with today's ensemble. As always, it's my wish for you to walk away from this conversation with a heaping helping of useful information that'll help you create a relationship that's as loving and accepting as possible. Let us know what you thought of today's show at Facebook.com/RelationshipFLove, on Twitter at Mr. That's M-R Frank Love, or at franklove.com. If you're listening via Blog Talk Radio, make sure you like us there, and if via iTunes, make sure you subscribe so that you can receive each week's show. This is Frank Love. We'll be right back.